Good morning, everyone. It is about 1:30 in the morning of May 1st, 2014. Welcome back. I hope that everything is well in your part of the world, or at least as well as it can be. Our spring continues to come on very slowly. It's still fairly cool here. And people are generally exhausted from this long winter. I mean, it's quite amazing how much of a toll an ongoing, difficult winter could be. There are now portions of the province that are experiencing some bad flooding, although it's not as bad as it has been at certain years. April was, how would I put it, a challenging month. Certain difficult relations with a number of people throughout the month. And among all of the usual routines with family, work, and friends, there just seemed to be always something demanding attention. I've had about six people write in over this past month, and we'll get down to that in a moment. But before we do, I want to thank all of you who have sent in your questions or comments of appreciation. I want to thank all of you who have ordered Buddhescence over the website. I want to thank those who have sent in donations. And as always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for establishing this website in the first place and for continuing to post these responses. And I want to remind everyone that whatever is offered on this website is simply for your consideration. If you're having any difficulty in relating to some of my responses to specific questions, and you're interested in really getting a sense of what it is I'm saying here, then it's important that you listen to the two main talks presented on this website. If you go to the Listen Dropbox on the site and you scroll down to the Talks heading, you'll find two talks. One is titled An Overview of Spiritual Awakening, and the second is titled Acknowledging the Moment. Now, this Acknowledging the Moment really isn't a talk. It's an invitation to a very detailed exploration of the actual happening of this moment. So if you're really wanting to get a sense of what's being presented on this website, it's important that you listen to those two presentations. All right. As I said, I've had about six people write in this month, and we'll get down to it. The first one is written in... Basically, this person stated that he had been involved with a non-dual interview, an interview based around non-duality. And there were a certain number of questions that were involved with that interview. So he had asked me what I thought of the questions. And we'll just go through these questions quickly. One of them was, what about suffering? Does enlightenment have anything to do with this? And not suffering anymore. So, within some of these spiritual presentations, whether it be some traditional presentation or the presentation of some independent individual, you know, might be presenting something generally called a non-dual sensibility, we often hear phrases like, you can eliminate all suffering. So it's very important that someone realize that this is referring to a mental anguish. So there's, along with the pain, what we would call the pains and difficulties of life, there's a certain amount of mental anguish or mental suffering that goes along with that. And it comes from always seeing the suffering of life, the pains and difficulties, as being something personal. And then really getting into these questions of, why is this happening to me? Poor me. Why me? Only me. Or we look upon these pains and difficulties as something that is a problem because we think it's wrong. Which is very interesting, because when any of us come out of the womb, you know, if we consider when we were babies, in our usual storyline, we don't have the impression that we thought anything was wrong with life. We didn't even know what life was. There was just this buzzing, pulsing, tingling event. And the next time you see an infant, or you're close to an infant, lean over and ask the child, is there a problem with life? And of course, for the child, there isn't any problem with life. There's no way, for the child, there isn't any way of saying what life is. The child doesn't even hear your question about, is there a problem? So in these teachings, when somebody presents the notion that you can eradicate human suffering, it's not saying you're going to get rid of the, what we call the pains and difficulties, and in what we sometimes call the unfairness of life. But what might happen is you'll realize that it isn't a matter of fair or unfair. It's not a situation of problems or anything wrong. And it's not a personal situation. So the Buddha once said that the only difference between his enlightened followers, his enlightened students, and the average person on the street is that the average person on the street suffers the pain of life twice. They experience the pains and difficulties that are there, even if we're not calling them pains and difficulties or not calling them anything. And then they suffer that again by making it personal and lying awake at night thinking, why is this happening to me? Poor me, only me, what about me? And always thinking of it in terms of life being unfair, or that somehow it's not correct. And the awakened student of the Buddha, he said, only suffers the pain of life once. They suffer what we might call the pains and difficulties that are there even when we don't say anything about life. However, they don't suffer that as a personal attack, a personal problem. They're not looking at it as something that's wrong. They simply acknowledge it as the natural expression of whatever this happening of this moment is. There's no way of saying what it is. No one's making it happen. So ultimately, it's not a problem, it's not a mistake, and it's not personal. If you ask yourself right now in this moment, what am I? What actually is? And you realize that you don't have a word for it. You already know that when you came out of the womb, you didn't have any word for it. And the only words that you have were sounds that you were taught to speak by your mother and father and your school system and the rest of society. So whether they taught you to say no, eye, ear, nose, seeing, hearing, touching, awareness, consciousness, atoms, molecules, dark energy, subliminal consciousness, mental analysis, mental health, isness, being, oneness, whatever sound they taught you to bark, that's not what this is. What were you before you started barking? So in this moment, ask yourself, what am I? What actually is right now? We have the feeling that something is happening. So ask yourself, what actually is this? And you'll find you don't have any name to give it other than a name you were taught to bark, other than a sound you were taught to bark. So ask yourself, what actually is right now, what actually is? And when you realize you have no name for it, and thought has come to stand still, it still feels like something's happening. There is this, what we would point to as this vibrancy, the vibrant, vital feeling of something happening. That's what is. That's what you are. It's not a thought, and there's no way that thought can say what this is. And when thought presents itself, we don't even know what that is. It's also just this vibrant, vital happening, making itself obvious. Another one of the questions was, at the point of death and the breakup of the body, what happens to the mind? Well, from this non-dual perspective, what we just ask the essential question, what actually is? When we ask that question, when we really truly explore what we would call the isness of this moment, what am I, what actually is, we discover we don't have a legitimate word for it. There is just this tingling, vibrant, pulsing happening, the basic feeling of something happening right now. Now, that's not a body, that's not a mind, that's not something that's been born, and not something that will disappear. Or our actual experience of it, the basic feeling of something that's happening, our only experience of it is that it seems to disappear, and then it seems to appear. So during the day, it seems to be here, and at night, in what we call deep sleep, it doesn't seem to be there, and then it seems to arise again. And we call it deep sleep only when it seems to be present again. We say that there was deep sleep occurring. So whatever this is, it has this vibrant pulsing quality, the pulsing of it somehow seems present, then it seems to disappear, then it seems to be present, then it seems to disappear, in the same way that the apparent breath comes and goes, the apparent each and every little tingle of the body arises and disappears and then arises again. Whatever this is, it doesn't seem to have any identifiable beginning, any ultimate beginning, and it doesn't seem to have any identifiable end. All right, another one of the questions is, would an enlightened person wear seductive clothing, makeup, have plastic surgery, implants, Botox, liposuction, and even color their hair to appear younger, more attractive? For their self-esteem or to attract followers, disciples, and clients? Who knows what an awakened being is going to do? Because one of the apparent points in this realization is that we're not ultimately making any of this happen. And another point is that in the world of apparent form, all of the expressions are unique. So the range of expression is endlessly unique. One of the really difficult realizations in this is that once there is the realization that there's no way of saying what's happening right now and no one's making it happen, and it's always been the case that there's no way of saying what's happening right now and no one is making it happen, in that realization, whatever this is will go on expressing itself in whatever way it expresses itself, and you don't get to say how it ultimately expresses itself. Another one of the questions is, what about knowledge? Some traditions say this is about knowledge only. What's your view on this? Do you think this is enough? The traditional use of this word knowledge is to point to what I was just mentioning. The knowledge is the realization that none of the descriptions apply to what's happening here. So again, if we ask the question, what am I? Or what actually is? And really seriously ask that question, and we're exploring from our own experience, if we ask ourselves right now, what actually is happening right now? So there's the general feeling that something is happening, this very basic pulse and tingle and vibration of the moment. And we may realize that we don't actually have a legitimate word for it. Whatever word we come up with was a sound that we were taught to speak. If we lived in a different country, it would be a different sound. The sound actually could be Blix, flute, or wazzle. So when we say that there's awareness or consciousness, that has no more meaning than if we were saying there's only Blix, flute, and wazzle. So if we sincerely ask ourselves right now, what am I? What we're left with is just this pulsing, vibrant happening. Even if we don't utter any word, it feels as though something's happening. That's what we are. It's not a word. It's not a thought. It's not a description. And there's no way of saying what it is. So that's knowledge. That's what these traditions are pointing to when they use the word knowledge. And yes, it's all about this knowledge. That's the only realization that we have to have. There's no way of saying what this is. And yet, here it is. And, I mean, what comes along immediately with that is it's just making itself obvious. There isn't anyone making it happen. There's just this happening. And when I use the word happening, it just points to this vibrant pulsing of the moment, the basic feeling that something's happening. There's no actual way of saying what it is. And no one's making it happen. That's knowledge. Another question is, would an enlightened person take sleeping pills, drink alcohol, take recreational drugs, smoke marijuana, drop LSD, or take medication for mood control, anxiety, depression, things such as Prozac or Viagra? Again, who knows how this is going to express itself? The only possible freedom is to realize that there's no way of saying what it is and that no one's making it happen. That's the only possible freedom in all of this. There's no way of saying what this is and no one is making it happen. So that whatever this is expressing itself in absolute freedom. It just is what it is. Now, even though there's no actual way of saying what it is, the happening that we might usually call depression may still express itself. It's just that there's no way of saying truly what that is. And the very natural response of going to the doctor, what we would call going to the doctor, getting medication for that depression, may still express itself, even with the awakening. All of that may still express itself, and all of that is the totally unexplainable happening. But whatever this is, all of that is also just as legitimately its expression as anything else. We can look at many of the really awakened, so-called awakened individuals, Alan Watts, Chogyam Trungpa, and many others. They didn't end up being some paradigm of perfection. Now, most people would be criticizing the behavior of those individuals, and yet those apparent individuals were very clear about what actually is. They knew that right now what is not something explainable. Descriptions don't apply to it. And no one's making it happen. No one's making any of it happen. In that realization, what you may lose is this constant feeling that there's something wrong with the expression of life. That there's some problem in the expression of life. There will still be what we call the pains and difficulties of life, but it's not a problem. It's not a mistake. It's not somebody's personal failure. There's no way of saying what it is. And so, as the Buddha pointed out, we will still experience the pains and difficulties of life, what we would call the pains and difficulties of life, but we won't then make a headache out of it. And believe me, it doesn't matter how deep your realization is, life can still present situations that are extremely, what we would call extremely painful and extremely difficult. But there will still be the realization that there's no way of saying what it actually is, and there is no inclination to start making it a problem or saying it's a mistake or getting into a whole personal thing of why me, what about me, what did I do wrong, why is this happening to me? Instead, it's just life being life. Another question is there a way to bypass this biological organism, the body? Well, here's the main question. What body? What biological organism? What actually is right now? Words like biological organism and the body are just sounds you were taught to bark. It's no different than teaching a seal to bark or a dog to bark. When we hear a dog barking, the dog is not explaining life in any deep philosophical way, and neither are we. Can an enlightened person lose their temper, use foul language or harsh speech, sarcasm, ridicule, make off-color jokes? Again, life can express itself in any way it expresses itself, and the range is endless. So, you know, just immediately what comes to mind is that the Buddha is recorded as having lost his temper in certain situations. The life of Christ was recorded, and in certain situations he lost his temper. U.G. Krishnamurti was very clear as to He was what we would call a very awakened individual, and yet quite a very snarly individual. And then the last portion of this, there were some questions involving, would an enlightened person make a legal disclaimer for their teachings as to not be held responsible? Could a disclaimer have something to do with an aversion to being sued or losing one's money or income? Why would an enlightened person fear the loss of income? For the same reason any other apparent person would fear the loss of income. Maybe it's not so important if you live someplace where it's constantly 90 degrees above and you can beg in the streets. But if you live in Winnipeg when it's 100 degrees below, losing your income becomes a matter of survival. And not everybody does survive when they lose their income. So why would an awakened person fear the loss of income in a situation like that? Because they're intelligent. Before I let this one go, just in a general consideration of these questions, you can see the kind of fantasy that's around the notion of awakening. All of these questions, it's almost like they're asking, don't you really turn into kind of a super being when you become awakened? Absolute perfection. You're just glowing and never making what we would call a mistake and never appearing to be less than anything but perfect. And all of that is hogwash. It's bullshit. Some of the most awakened beings appear to be not very highly developed human beings. However, they live always with this sense that there's no way of saying what any of this actually is. And there's no one making any of it happen. So for them, there is only a magical dance of apparent events. Totally magical in a way, because it all just simply unfolds or presents itself in whatever way it presents itself, and it can still be what we call the most painful, confusing, difficult things you could possibly imagine. And yet there's always this ongoing sense that there's no true way of saying what it is. And in that, when we realize there's no true way of saying what this is, then the body is gone, the mind is gone, the problems are gone. The feeling that there's anything incorrect is gone. Even though what we would usually call extreme pains and extreme difficulties may still be presenting themselves, there's no way of really saying what that is. So it's not really pain and difficulty, and there's no problem with it and nothing wrong with it, because all of it is the natural expression of whatever this is. All right, another person had written in last month to ask a question, or 2 months ago to ask a question, and I responded to it last month, and so he sent in another question. Hi, Daryl. I heard your answer to my question in your recent talk that appeared on your site yesterday and found it quite clear and brought things into perspective, especially around my personal part in addiction. However, it still leaves me with the difficult part of not being able to share this understanding with fellow addicts/clients who may not be ready to hear this. Although, as you quite rightly point out, fellowships like Alcoholics Anonymous definitely have the element of powerlessness and non-dependence on their own self to lift them out of addiction. But there are some models of addiction that depend upon personal choice and responsibility, like smart recovery or other counseling techniques like CBT. I don't really know what CBT is. As I am studying a course that uses these models, and I may have to implement them in the future if I start working as a counselor, this is where my dilemma lies. I can't integrate this viewpoint with your perspective, which I have such a strong affinity for, myself. And that's what I meant when I said I will feel like a hypocrite. Another question that arose when you answered my question on how this perspective can help make life easier to accept is that, why is there so much suffering and hardship in the first place? Why does it happen that some addicts do not have the urge and some do? Why is Syria or any other group of people going through so much suffering? Why so many diseases, so much torture and pain? These questions have plagued me since childhood, as I'm sure it may have done to others who have ever looked around to question existence. I can understand the suffering of clinging and attachment to transitory forms that the Buddha talks about, but what about the more macroscopic suffering that is rampant on such a wide scale? I'm sorry to bother you with more questions, Daryl, as you have already explained quite elaborately your essential message, and I do not expect you to answer these questions. But if you think I'm missing the point here, then please, can you point out even briefly as to which part of your perspective will dispel these issues? I'm grateful enough for what you've said and written so far. Thanks. All right, so very briefly, as this person is pointing out, he will be dealing with clients within a situation of dealing with addiction, and is having trouble reconciling the fact that some of the therapies he will be offering will be using the notion of personal choice and responsibility, and at the same time he doesn't actually have a full belief in the ideas of personal choice and responsibility. He can see ultimately it's the movement of existence itself. And would like to share that with his clients. However, he won't be able to. And this is the same situation I find myself in, that every day I hear people expressing difficulties with their life, but I can't just step up and give them, you know, present a non-dual perspective, because that's not something that the average person relates to. And the weird thing is that even the people who do want it, even the people who go out searching for a lifetime, don't really want what the actual non-dual perspective is. And you can see that, because most of the people out there doing spiritual practice, doing meditation practices, going to various non-dual presenters, they don't really want the non-dual perspective. Or they want it, but they just don't want it now. So it's a very difficult thing to express even to people who are asking about it, who are thirsting for it. So one of the things that, you know, if you do acknowledge this sense of existence, that there's no way of saying what's happening and that there's no one making any of it happen, it's just happening. If you do acknowledge this, then one of the things you're faced with is that there are not that many people who are really interested in this. So in this situation of dealing with clients, you're going to have to offer them what they're interested in, because that's what they'll be able to use, or that's what they'll be able to relate to. You can't simply offer them what you're interested in, because if you go out on the into the street and start spouting this non-dual sensibility to everyone, pretty soon society is going to shun you. So even for those who do express it and offer it, they only offer it to the ones who are asking about it, who are interested in it, who truly want to explore the actual happening of existence. And the second part of this was, why is there so much suffering and hardship in the first place? Well, ultimately, it's not suffering and hardship. There's no way of saying what this is. However, what we call suffering and hardship, that happening is still expressing itself. And in relation to that, just look around. Look around the world. Look around at any situation in nature. You have strong creatures preying on the weak. You have certain creatures born with certain apparent difficulties. You have creatures that have no food to eat, no water to drink. So nature everywhere is presenting the fact that whatever this is, these so-called hardships and difficulties are part of the expression, part of the apparent happening. There's no way of saying what it actually is, but what we call hardship and difficulty, what we call torture and war and all the rest of it, that exists in any realm of nature, whether it's microscopic microbes, whether it's the little creatures of the forest, the little creatures of the desert, the little creatures of the sea. These hardships and difficulties are being expressed everywhere. So here's the real question. We're also part of the expression. Why do you think we're not going to have that? That's part of the natural expression of whatever this is. Ultimately, we can't say it's a problem and we can't say it's wrong, because there's no way of saying what it is. And that doesn't mean we're going to sit around and ignore it if we have this so-called awakening, because it's also the very natural expression of whatever this is to try to avoid that, to see if it's possible to eliminate it. And there's no way of saying what all of that is either. It's just the expression of whatever this is. Again, this is just for your consideration. This is what is classically known as a non-dual sensibility. But I'm not saying you have to look at life in this way. It's just for your consideration. All right, another person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. I suffer from chronic pain for many years now. Despite the fact that I have a good understanding of the basis of non-duality, the experience of life is often painful here, and I don't feel, as you wrote in your books, an openness to life. I know that I have no control over anything, and that everything is changing, but there is still suffering and resistance and the wanting to find a way out. And the wanting to find a way out makes them worse. I would like to have your light on this question. How would you consider chronic pain and the associated painful feelings and emotions as far as the non-dual perspective is concerned? Thank you for your answer and your accurate non-dual perspective." So what immediately comes up with this is to point out that the Buddha suffered chronic back pain through most of his life, and there are very detailed descriptions of how in certain situations he might be giving a teaching and he was unable to go on with the teaching because the physical pain was so extreme that he had to give up that particular teaching And he would lie down on the ground to try to alleviate some of the pain, the extreme pain. And he would have to let another monk finish the teaching. So he would lie down behind that monk while that monk finished the teaching, because his, what we would call physical pain, was just so incredibly difficult to deal with. It's also the case that there are descriptions of him in the early morning, as the sun was coming up, he would be sitting with his back to the sun, and he would have lowered the upper part of his robe so that the sun could strike his back, because that warmth from the sun was one of the few things that would give him relief from this chronic pain. So from this non-dual perspective, it's the case that even with a very profound awakening to the facts of life, that there's no way of saying what this is, the very happening of this moment, there's no real way of saying what it is. So in that, in a way we could say the pain disappears. You know, there's no way of ultimately saying what it is, but the fact is that what we usually call pain may still be expressing itself. And so in opening to life as it actually is, a totally unexplainable happening, just happening, it may still be what we call extremely painful, even though there's no way of saying what it actually is, and it may still express an urge to avoid that. It will obviously express an urge to explore how to avoid it, even though there's no way of saying what this is. It will be expressing an urge to avoid it, what we would call an urge to avoid it. And so we may still apparently look like somebody going to a doctor and wanting to avoid pain and wanting to explore what's possible within this situation and what's not possible. And that's going to happen whether you're awakened or not. So that what we call pain, what we call the urge to avoid this, and what we call the search or the exploration to see what's possible and not possible, is simply acknowledged as a totally unexplainable happening presenting itself. Now, this matter of awakening, of realization, this whole matter of non-dual, a non-dual sensibility, is not guaranteeing you that when you have this awakening, everything's going to be pleasant, or there'll be no more confusion. It's pointing out that whatever this is going to express itself in whatever way it expresses itself, that ultimately we're not making any of it happen. No one is making it happen. And it will express itself in whatever way it expresses itself. And just as in the Buddha's case, it may express a life of ongoing chronic pain. So in this non-dual sensibility, we're really left with, you know, we haven't, a particular situation arises. And maybe it's a situation that's not so pleasant. So an apparent response to that situation arises. And very naturally, it's an urge to avoid what we would call difficulty or pain. And so very naturally, it becomes a demand to explore the potential of that situation. But it's never the situation that someone is in absolute control. So whether you have a dual sense of existence or a non-dual sense of existence, it's never the, in neither case do you have the feeling that you're in absolute control of existence. So it always ends up that whatever situation you seem to be in, it's always simply a voyage of discovery. It's a situation of exploring, you know, if there's a demand that something be explored, if there's an urge to explore it, it's always simply an exploration of what life will ultimately allow and what it won't allow, what life will ultimately express itself as and what it won't express itself as. It's never a situation that you awaken and then have absolute control and you can just wipe out any pain, what we would call pain or difficulty. So with this awakening, it's always simply a totally unexplainable happening presenting itself. And in that, it may still present what we would call pains and difficulties, but there will be the realization that there's no true way of saying what it is, and that we're not, it's not a matter of just having the awakening and wiping out all apparent pain and difficulty. And so from moment to moment, within the world of apparent form and within our daily storylines, it becomes a voyage of discovery. And we don't really know from moment to moment just exactly how it's going to express itself. We don't really know its ultimate potential. So when we're dealing with something like chronic pain, this is an extremely difficult situation. It will feel like an extremely difficult situation. It will at times feel extremely confusing. But from this non-dual sensibility, if that is the situation, it always remains within our daily life. It always remains an exploration of this situation, an exploration of what is possible and what is not possible, an exploration of whether or not life is offering a small bit of relief if we apparently do certain things, whether it might offer a large relief in certain other situations. However, it's from this non-dual perspective, it's not guaranteeing you that there will be any relief, because ultimately whatever this is simply expressing itself in whatever way it expresses itself. And unfortunately, for all of us, it will still express apparent difficulties and hardships. All right, another person has written in, "Happy springtime, Daryl." It might be interesting to talk about the illusion of the past, of time. What we often describe as a sense of self, consciousness, awareness, whatever is occurring in a now that can't be compared and thus can't truly be a now at all, let alone a presence or a moment or any other arbitrary word. Furthermore, any speculation about how that works begs the question, takes for granted a thing happening upon a substratum of time, a fictive background that I am. Most self-styled, pardon the pun, non-duality teachers insist, while the appearances are elusive, look for the awareness in which they happen, as if there are two moments in which to go from one perception to another. The fictive spiritual search is a mirage depicting someone searching for someone, with a capital O, searching for someone. A beginningless and endless flicker picture of someone who is trying to find himself. A joke, really. Not a cosmic joke. Rather a joke that thinks it's cosmic. God, awareness, Buddha nature, etc. are words we use to cover our bewilderment about bewilderment. The illusion of time and the past seem to be necessary elements of the fantasy. Would you kindly dismantle this fantasy for the enjoyment of friends? friends, fans, and foes around the world. Thanks. All right. Yeah, time. Okay, again, once more. Let's just seriously ask, like, you know, once again, we all have the feeling that something is happening right now. Now, let's just seriously ask ourselves, what is this? What actually is? And just at the end of the question, just rest for a bit. What actually is? Now, at the end of the question, it, for a moment, there's no thought, but it still feels like something's happening. And when a thought comes, we can realize that that's a word that we were taught to bark. Like our parents taught us that word. Whatever it is we're saying, either our parents or our society taught us that word. But that word is not this happening. And the word isn't telling us what this happening is. So it doesn't matter whether we're saying I'm a man or a woman or a mind or a consciousness or an awareness or that there is time, that it's a moment, a present moment. It doesn't matter what we say. That's not what this is. So the ultimate acknowledgement in this non-dual sensibility is that we ask the question, what is this? And finally, no thought comes, no label comes. But it still feels like something's happening. And whatever that is, that's what is. That's what we are. This is not a thought. And there's no way that thought can say what it is. So now, normally we're walking around thinking we're a person, going through a world of form, a world of things, and that this is happening over a period of time. Again, from this non-dual perspective, what actually is always obvious, but no one's interested in it. No one really wants to explore that. Everyone wants to put their focus on something else, and that something else is the descriptions. Nobody wants to look at what is. Everyone wants to live in descriptions. However, if we start examining the descriptions, we realize they don't match our actual experience. So right now, it feels like something is happening. We would call that the present moment. The present moment is just a sound that we were taught to bark. It points to this unexplainable happening. But it's this happening is what we call the present moment. Now, if we really look at our experience, we've never experienced anything other than the present moment. It always feels, you know, when we consider what actually is, what might be termed reality, we always know that the actual happening of the present moment is more real than the memory of a past or the idea about a future, because the memory about a past is happening now and the idea about a future is happening now. And that idea about the past doesn't have the same feeling of reality as the actual happening of now. And the idea about the future doesn't have, you know, that future doesn't have the same reality, the feel of reality, what we call reality, that the happening of this moment has. So we have the feeling that what we call the present happening, just this happening of this moment, is more real than the memory of the past, or more real than the past that we're remembering, and more real than the future that we're imagining. because we know those are just realms of ideas. Now, if we really consider it, we have never experienced anything other than what we call the happening of this moment. It's always just the happening of this moment. You don't feel like you're living in the past right now. You don't feel like you're living in the future right now. You're thinking about the past or the future. You always feel like you're living right now. That's all that's ever experienced by anyone. And if there is only that, if that's the only actuality, then there is no real past or future. And if there is no real past or future, we can't say this is a present. We don't know what this is. It's obvious there is this isness, what we call just this happening. We have the feeling that something is happening right now. But if we seriously ask ourselves, what is this? There's no way of saying what it is. It's not a self. It's not consciousness. It's not a body. It's not a world. It's not time. It's not a present moment. It's just this. And it's not even that. Again, let's go further than saying it's just this doing what it does. Let's seriously ask the question, what actually is right now, what actually is? And we may realize that there's no way of saying what this is. You can't even say it's isness or being. Those are words, in our whole storyline, those are words we were taught to bark. They have no more meaning than words like blix and flute and wazzle. They just point to whatever this is. Again, when we ask the question, what is there when there is no thinking? Or we can say, we can ask the question, what am I really? There may be the realization that there's no way of saying what this is, but it still feels as though something's happening. A vibrant, pulsing event that has no name. It has no particular form. There's no way of saying what it is. No one has ever experienced anything called time. That's why Einstein says, or used to say, time is an illusion. It's an absolute illusion. And that's why Stephen Hawking will ultimately say, time is ultimately an illusion. They're simply pointing out that no one has ever actually experienced the passage of time. We experience what we call change. It seems as though life has a particular form, and then that changes. And it seems that it has a new form. And we say that happens over time, but we don't actually experience anything called time. There's what we call change. But if we really examine that change, there actually isn't any change taking place. Because what is doesn't have any stable form. So it's always something that has no stable form. It's more accurately what we might call the ongoing absence of form. However, if we get into describing forms, we will ultimately end up describing the notion of change. And that notion of change will seem to be occurring over time. However, if we'd really truly ask ourselves, what actually is right now? There's no way of saying what it is. There's no way of saying what is. But that doesn't mean there's nothing. It doesn't feel as though there's nothing. It still feels as though something is making itself obvious. That's not a thought. That's not time. That's not a person. There's no way of saying what that is. And the fact of the matter, the fact of this happening is that no matter how much you're tangled up in thought, no matter how much you're tangled up in stories, if you really, truly, legitimately ask yourself, what really is? At any moment, if you ask yourself, what really is? What actually is in this moment? You may realize there's no way of saying what this is. Because it's quite obvious, even in our storyline, we have the story that says when we came out of the womb, we didn't have a storyline. And our storyline says that our mothers and fathers taught us the storyline for this, taught us to bark these sounds. So the question becomes, what were you before you started barking? Because these apparent words just point to this totally unexplainable happening. But they don't tell us what it is. So what were you before you started barking? Now you don't have to go to the past to discover that, because that's what still is. Right now, what really is? Ask yourself that. What actually is right now? What am I right now? And simply realize that the only intellectual response is a sound that you were taught to bark. And that sound never told you what this is. It just started labeling what this is. So when you legitimately ask that question, what actually is right now, there is no intellectual answer. There is no thought that ultimately can come forward to say what it is. And yet it still feels like something's happening, even when no thought is present. And when thought eventually, what we call thought, comes back, we might realize that there's no way of saying what that is either. It's not actually something called thought. It also is just this vibrant, pulsing, unexplainable happening, making itself obvious. Anyway, that's all that's coming up with that question. Now this next one, it's not so much a question, but somebody had written in to question some of my phrasing, saying that I wasn't really using it wasn't really making sense, some of my phrasing. So for instance, I was talking about what actually is, and then in the next breath I was saying something like, what is simply this unexplainable happening expressing itself. And this person was pointing out that the word is can't really be equated with the idea of an unexplainable happening expressing itself, because that's not the literal translation or the literal meaning of the word is, which is absolutely true. It's not. But bear with me here, because I'm making an attempt to point to something that's incredibly difficult to point to. And ultimately what I'm pointing to is not an isness, it's not a being, it's not awareness, it's not consciousness, and ultimately it's not an unexplainable happening, simply happening. These are words that just point to whatever this is. So again, maybe the more exact way of pointing to this would be, let's ask the question, what actually is right now? And you can't tell me it's an isness. You can't tell me it's a being. Because those words don't tell us anything. Those are, you were, in your apparent storyline, you were taught to bark word, these words, and these words just point to this, whatever this is. Again, if we ask the question, what actually is in this moment, and we realize that we don't have any true label for it, that all we have are sounds that we were taught to bark, then there's no way of saying what this is, and yet it obviously doesn't feel like there's nothing happening. So whatever this is, that's the ground floor. And there's no way of actually saying what it is. So in that pointing, when I first attempted to express this, I was using most of the traditional terms that would be found in what we call Advaita. And what I realized was that most of those traditional terms are causing more confusion than clarity. So I began experimenting with other terms that allowed the average person to relate to this whole perspective, this whole non-dual sensibility. It would allow them to relate this sensibility to their actual experience, to terms that they actually used on an everyday basis, something they could relate to more easily. And so one of the very first online comments about what it is I was, about what it is that I'm offering, one of the first online comments to appear was someone made the statement that I have an unusual clarity in my pointing, but that clarity has nothing to do based on the exactness of words. The clarity doesn't come from me using words in a more exact way than most other pointers. Because when I'm pointing, I'm using something else to bring that clarity. And so in that, my use of words becomes, or is, a little bit loose. All right. And that brings us to the final question. Somebody had a curiosity about a question, about a situation where they heard somebody ask a non-dual presenter about deep sleep. And the question was whether it's possible to knowingly enter deep sleep. So the person was basically asking whether deep sleep for an awakened being is different from deep sleep for an average person. Is there some kind of knowledge in deep sleep? Do you know that you are during it? And this non-dual presenter said that yes, there is an awareness in deep sleep. There is simply pure consciousness, totally undisturbed. That there is simply pure consciousness that is aware of nothing but itself. And that's how it is when deep sleep is happening for a realized being. However, that's not true. That doesn't really, that's not in accordance with a classical non-dual perspective. So 2,800 years ago, it was presented very clearly that an awakened being in deep sleep is not asleep. Now that sounds really impressive. It sounds almost superhuman. And it's very important that you take it within the larger context that it was said, because it was also saying that an awakened being, even when being stupid, is not stupid. And even when being confused is not confused. And even when being clear is not clear. So that's what they were meaning when they were saying that an awakened being, even in deep sleep, is not asleep. What they're saying is, none of these descriptions apply. So, the whole notion that there's somebody who's knowing something in this moment is a fantasy. And it's also the case that there's someone knowing something in deep sleep is a fantasy. All we can ever actually come to in what we call this non-dual sensibility is ultimately a happening that can't be explained. And those words are not trying to explain it. It's just pointing to it. So a more direct way of pointing to it is this. We both have the feeling, whoever's listening to this right now, we all have the feeling that something is happening right now. Tell me what it is. Please, tell me what it is right now. And don't give me a word you were taught to bark. Tell me what it actually is. And the fact of the matter is there's no way of saying what it is. So what were you before your parents started to, before your parents taught you to automatically bark these sounds? You don't have to go to the past to find out what you were, because you still are that. What are you right now? And don't give me a word you were taught to bark. So maybe it'll become obvious that there's no way of saying what this is, and no word comes to say what this is. And yet it still feels like something's happening. It doesn't feel like nothing is happening. There is this kind of vibrant, pulsing happening that we would call the actual happening of this moment. What is that? What is this? There's no way of saying, and yet it doesn't feel as though there's nothing happening. So what is cannot be described, it cannot be named, and that's what is. That's what we are. That's all that's ever expressing itself. We can open our eyes and look around and ask ourselves, what is this? Anywhere you look, ask, what is this? And the fact of the matter is, you don't have any way of truly saying what this is. So again, in my invitation to acknowledge the moment, we go through an exploration of this pulsing, vibrant happening of the moment. And then, towards the end of that exploration, that acknowledgement, we ask the question, what is there when there is no thinking? And at the end of the question, there's no thought, but it doesn't feel like there's nothing. So whatever this is, it's not a thought, but it's not nothing. And that's all that is. Even the so-called thoughts that come, those are not something we can legitimately call thoughts. The word thought is just a word we were taught to bark, a sound we were taught to bark. So, normally we have the impression that thinking precedes an action. But that, if we explore that, we realize that that's not actually true. Thinking itself is a totally unexplainable action. It's also this totally unexplainable, vibrant, pulsing happening that can't be explained. It's actually not something called thinking. There isn't anyone making it happen. It just happens. So thought does not precede an action. Thought itself is a totally unexplainable action or vibrancy presenting itself. All there ever is this unexplainable vibrant vitality, a pulsing dynamic, an urge, a force, an unexplainable vitality expressing itself. All right, and that brings us to the end of this month's questions and considerations. Again, as always, this is only for your consideration. I'm not saying you have to see life in this way or that you even have to consider this. And again, it's important that if you are considering my responses, that you all also listen to those two main talks at some point. An overview of spiritual awakening and the acknowledging the moment, which is not really a talk, it's an actual invitation to acknowledge this vibrant vitality of the moment, the vibrant, vital, dynamic dance of existence. So if you're interested in this, that's great. If you're not interested in this, that's just as great. Whatever's happening, it's the totally legitimate expression of whatever this is. All right, so take care till next time. I hope that this next month brings you only good things, but I know with absolute certainty it's going to bring you an apparent mixed bag of things. What we call good, bad, up, down, and all around. Even though we can't actually say what any of it is. So till next time, take care. Bye.